All right. Our sermon today comes from Exodus 6. It says 10 through 30, but I actually decided to go with 14 through 30, which says, "These are the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the clans of Reuben. The sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of the Canaanite woman. These are the clans of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, the years of the life of Levi being 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni, and Shimei by their clans, the sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, Uziel, the years of the life of Kohath being 133 years, the sons of Merari, Mahlai, and Mushai. These are the clans of the Levites according to their generations. Amram took as his wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, the years of the life of Amram being 137 years. The sons of Izhar, Korah, Nepheg, and Zichri, the sons of Uziel, Mishael, Elsaphan, and Ziphri. Aaron took as his wife Elisheba, the daughter of Aminadab, and the sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. The sons of Korah, Asir, Elkanah, and Abiasaph. These are the clans of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took as his wife one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans. These are the Aaron and Moses, to whom the Lord said, 'Bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their hosts.' It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing about the people of Israel from Egypt, this Moses and this Aaron. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, 'I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you.' But Moses said to the Lord, 'Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me?'" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You can be seated. All right. Well, most of what we just read is a genealogy. The listing out of generations of particular family lines. And I know a lot of people are tempted when they're reading the Bible to kind of skim through the genealogies, but you get extra holiness points if you actually read them. So congratulations on that. I want you to keep something in mind as we examine this passage, and that is knowing where we come from or who we came from can be an emboldening thing. If you are related to someone famous, or someone who has had maybe incredible success in a particular area, that's something that we don't mind bringing up in conversation. We like to associate with kind of success in our relations. The relation or connection with someone who has gained that kind of fame is usually something to be excited about. When we look back at our ancestors, some of you might know much, or maybe don't know much about your ancestors, the generations that came before. Others have probably traced their ancestry back pretty far. And when you look back at the stories of previous generations, there's often a feeling of pride in who they were. For us today, it often involves looking back at the lives of our grandparents or our great-grandparents and being inspired by the hardships they went through, maybe. Perhaps the wars they fought, the number of children they raised, and how hard they worked and what they accomplished. Just a quick note on that from my family. It's been I don't know a lot, but it's been fascinating to look back at the two sides of my family, my mother's side and my father's side. They went through some incredible stuff that I think we often take for granted. On both sides of my family, my grandparents lived through the Great Depression, were involved in the fighting of World War II. Their grandparents were the generation of immigrants who came to the United States in the late 1800s, had to work incredibly hard to farm and establish communities in what were still basically frontiers of the United States. There are stories in the early years settling in Washington State for my family on my mother's side. They immigrated from Norway. They had a farm on the peninsula of Washington State, and they would load up the produce from their farm and row it across the Puget Sound, the stormy, cold Puget Sound, to sell their goods in Seattle at Pike Place Market back in the early 1900s. That was their origin. And then my great-grandfather fought in World War I. My grandfather fought in World War II as a paratrooper. And there's a lot of it's cool to look back, but there's also something emboldening about it. I actually have the journal of my grandfather from World War II. It's pretty amazing to be able to look back and see what he was thinking and what he was going through at that time. On my father's side, they came from Ireland, settled in Minnesota, when there were still native tribes living there. And there's short stories of them interacting, and you know, natives who had hunted deer would come to their farm and trade things and things like that. There's some cool stories as they were scratching out a living in Minnesota. And while I may never know all the details of their lives, the stories that I do have are incredibly impactful. Their stories led to my story. Knowing where we come orientates us. It gives us perspective on our lives today. And it should embolden us, because often what previous generations went through was, generally speaking, harder, more toilsome than we experience today. And lastly, looking back at our own genealogies should encourage us to think about what comes after us. It reminds us that there will be those who come after who will be greatly impacted by what we do now and how we live day to day. But getting back to our passage in Exodus 6, this particular genealogy in verses 14 through 25 of Exodus 6, at first glance, may seem to come out of nowhere in the story of Exodus. We often see these descriptions of generations at the beginning or the end of a book of the Bible, but this one is placed right in the middle of a story. And let's quickly review what has happened just before this genealogy is listed. Moses has gone to Pharaoh, who has refused his request to let the Hebrews go. Not only that, but in response to Moses' request, he increased the workload for the Hebrew slaves, now requiring them to get their own straw for bricks. The foreman and some of the Hebrew people have turned on Moses. Stuart has preached about that the last couple weeks. They said, "You have made us stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants." So in a time when everything seemed hopeless, and we see this in the first half of chapter 6, God reminds Moses of his covenant and his promises. He basically tells Moses, don't think about how miserable you feel. Don't look at the impossibility of the situation you are in. Remember what I told you. And he repeats his promises to deliver his people. And then starting in verses 10 through 13, God tells Moses again to go to Pharaoh and tell him to let his people go. And Moses again tries to get out of it. You and I can probably relate to Moses here. He is looking at an impossible situation. He is despised by Pharaoh and by his own people. Things are getting worse, not better. There doesn't appear to be any chance of the Hebrews overcoming this great empire, much less gain freedom. And he responds by saying, I don't want to do it. I do not want to do this. Specifically, he tells God that he is of uncircumcised lips, possibly referring again to his poor speaking ability, but also could be a reference to the time not long ago that God tried to kill Moses for not circumcising his children. And then we have this genealogy in the story, sort of like a commercial break. Kind of right as the action's about to pick up, we get a list of generations. God, through the writing of Moses, years later, decides to pause the story and tell us who came before and who comes after by way of genealogy. So let's take a closer look here at the genealogy itself, and I think there's some gems to find in it. First, we see this genealogy is tying Aaron and Moses back to Jacob. In verses 14 through 16, we see the sons of Reuben, Simeon, and Levi listed out. So first, you have Jacob, the father, the most direct patriarch of the Hebrews to whom Moses was writing. And then he goes through the sons of Reuben, the firstborn, then Simeon, the secondborn of Jacob, then Levi, the thirdborn. And the people to whom Moses was writing probably knew the significance of Levi. His descendants would be the priestly tribe, the intercessors for the people. Not only that, Moses and Aaron were Levites, both on their mother's side and their father's side. And as we continue through the genealogy, we see that one of the sons of Levi was Kohath. One of the sons of Kohath was Amram. Amram married his aunt, which his readers, you know, would have known was a no-no at that point. But Moses doesn't hide that fact. But both Amram and Jochebed were Levites. So up to this point, what does this do for the reader of Exodus back when Moses wrote it? Well, remember, he wrote this when they were in the wilderness. In fact, he probably wrote it near the end of their time in the wilderness before entering the promised land. And one thing that this genealogy did for this people is remind them that as they were, you know, at times even rebelling against Moses, once they even threatened to kill Moses, they often questioned whether Moses and Aaron were the ones that should be leading. This reminds them that they were legitimate priests, direct descendants of Levi, and it reminds their hearers of who they are, the sons and daughters of Jacob. And just like it can be encouraging and emboldening for us to look back at our ancestors, at who they were, what they did, for the Hebrews in the middle of the wilderness, in the middle of hopelessness and doubt, they were reminded here of who they are, of where they came from, and that God's promises are indeed for them. This genealogy also traces the line of Levi to a man named Korah. Korah was the first cousin of Moses and Aaron and also a direct descendant of Levi. And do you guys remember what Korah is known for in the Bible, or most known for? Well, in Numbers 16, he leads a rebellion against Moses and Aaron. And these rebels, led by Korah, claim that Moses and Aaron had exalted themselves above the people unjustly. Korah was joined from some of the tribe of Reuben, and total 250 leaders or elders of Israel joined in this rebellion against Moses' leadership. And in short, God destroyed them. So while this genealogy traces the ancestry of Moses and Aaron, explaining their legitimacy as priests and leaders, it also explains why Korah thought that he could lead. We get this picture of Korah's rebellion where this true Levite, Korah, he was kind of an alternate Aaron, an alternative high priest, someone else who could have been chosen for that position by God, but wasn't. This Korah believes that Moses and Aaron have gone too far. They have too much power, too much influence. And he joins with the Reubenites, descendants of the firstborn of Jacob. And their claim to be the ones who should rule instead of Moses and Aaron is explained in the genealogy. They could say that they had just as much of a right to rule as Moses and Aaron based on where they came from and who they were. But when Moses hears of their intention to rebel in Numbers 16, he falls on his face, we're told. He knows about the ruin that this rebellion against God will bring. And I encourage you guys to go back and read maybe this week Numbers 16. It's a fascinating read, and read it in light of Exodus 6, what God tells us about Korah and about the other Israelites. But a simple application is that God's people, according to the way that God has told his story throughout the Bible and throughout history, are not rebels, or at least they shouldn't be rebels at heart. They don't place their ultimate hope in the will of the people or in any ideology that seeks continuously to cast off authority. And that doesn't mean that Christians sit idly by when evil rulers are in power. And we see examples of godly resistance in the book of Exodus itself. We read about the Hebrew midwives, right? Shiphrah and Puah, who resisted Pharaoh's evil commands. But in short, Christians should not be rebels. We should be reformers. I'm reading a book, as far as I can tell, written by an atheist about Christianity and paganism in the Roman Empire during the early church. And I just read a section on the intense persecutions of Christians. And the author makes note that there is not a single recorded time or any evidence at all that Christians ever tried to violently rebel against Rome or attack any of their pagan neighbors. Isn't that incredible? Throughout the hundreds of years of persecution, there's not any evidence. And this is written by an atheist who's pretty skeptical of Christian history, but he recognizes that that was the way that Christians lived. And this isn't an argument for pacifism either. Historic and biblical Christianity has the proper categories for violence and self-defense or in just war. And there are times where God commanded violence in the book of Exodus to purge evil from the midst of the people. But even the Christians being persecuted in Rome did not become rebels. But in the end, the Christians in Rome conquered Rome. They didn't use any violence, but the Christians in Rome conquered Rome. The Roman Empire in its twilight became Christian. From the poor, even to the wealthy, to the emperor himself, Christianity, by the power of the Holy Spirit, the spread of the good news, took over. God did that, in short. They loved their neighbors, saved babies from abortion and infanticide, had families of their own, preached the gospel, were willing to be martyred for it, and God used a hopeless situation to bring about something that only he could do. Again, a simple way to state this point is that Christians aren't rebels, they are reformers. Something else that becomes plain in this genealogy in Exodus 6 is that the family that God chooses to use for his purposes is not a perfect family. The genealogy starts with the oldest son of Jacob. It was normal to start with the oldest and work your way down. Well, Reuben, the eldest son of Jacob, we know from Genesis 35, is cursed and disinherited for sleeping with his father's concubine, the mother of Dan and Naphtali, his brothers. So Reuben is the firstborn, and this explains why in Korah's rebellion there were Reubenites involved. They were descendants of the firstborn. Normally, they would have had a claim to rule, but God had rejected them. Then we get to Simeon, who we are told in Exodus 15 married a Canaanite woman. And now this is not directly condemned here, and we know that many times throughout the Old Testament, non-Hebrews were brought in as followers of God, but there does seem to be an intentional contrast here between the line of Simeon, the secondborn, which came from a Canaanite, and the people, the Canaanites were the people that were going to get wiped out because of their generations of wickedness, and the family of the next son of Jacob, Levi, in the genealogy. So we get to Levi, the third son of Jacob, in verse 16. The tribe of Levi becomes the focus of this genealogy. It doesn't keep going through all the sons of Jacob. It stops at the third son. And while the lines of Reuben and Simeon are only traced two generations from Jacob, Levi's is traced further out. In fact, all the way to Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, and a contemporary of the writing of this book. Phinehas would have been around when this was written. So in other words, this genealogy traces the line of Aaron specifically all the way from Jacob to the time that the book of Exodus was written. But even the line of Levi, while the genealogy clearly demonstrates that the Levites are genuine, pure Israelites, and that Moses and Aaron are pure Levites, their line is not all roses. Moses includes the detail that his father and mother had a relationship that would have been forbidden at the time of the writing of Exodus. We see in verse 20 that Moses' father, Amram, married his father's sister, Jochebed. So their family line is not perfect by any stretch, and Moses doesn't hide it. But he is laying out that, yes, we are legitimate Levites. We are priests of God. And if anything, if we look at their parents, they're a little too Levite, if you know what I mean. I was going to make an Alabama joke or something like that, but we'll keep moving. Something about the lineage of Levi that also becomes apparent is that they are passionate, even violent people. But their passion and violence is usually justified, not always. Look at Levi himself. He was one of the sons of Jacob who tricked the town of Shechem. Do y'all remember this story? Into receiving circumcision, only to attack and kill all the men of the city, 3,000. This was done after their sister Dinah was defiled and was about to be given in marriage to her defiler. Jacob had done nothing about it, and Simeon and Levi took matters into their own hands. And some commentators think this is why, after Reuben was rejected, Simeon and Levi were also passed over as the rulers of Israel. And that, of course, would be the tribe of Judah that would eventually rule. So we see that Levi was passionate for justice, desiring to defend the honor of his sister, but he did so unjustly. Moses murdered an Egyptian. But jumping ahead, it is the Levites who stand with Moses after the golden calf incident at Mount Sinai, and it is they who carry out God's wrath on the unfaithful in the camp, killing those who basically had rejected God and followed this idol by the command of God. Then let's go all the way to the end of the genealogy. In chapter 6, we see Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, listed. He was the one, and I think Stuart referenced this in maybe his last sermon or the one before, when the Israelites were commanded not to take Canaanite wives, he was the only one to actually enforce God's command by killing a man and his Midianite concubine who were flaunting their rebellion. And God honored him for it and then relented in his wrath against the people. And we moderns have become pretty pacified. We we get uncomfortable, perhaps, when we think about what these faithful men did and how they wielded their strength for violence. But it was not meaningless violence. And barring the examples of Levi and the town of Shechem and Moses and his murder of the Egyptian, it was not unjust violence. In fact, if we trace all these examples in order, we see the violence of the Levites go from unjust to just. Reactionary and full of wrath to being in line with God's will and command. There's a trajectory towards justice in the violence of the family of Levi, from unjust to just. And this most violent of tribes was the one that God decided to be the priests. Isn't that interesting? We could say that the violence culminates in the sacrificial system. The Levites became the priests, and they did violence daily in the form of animal sacrifice as a representation of the cost of sin and the cleansing power of a truly righteous sacrifice. And of course, all of this pointed forward to Christ. On the cross, Christ received the violence that we deserved, and he conquered sin forever. And now I want you to think about the context of the writing of this genealogy. And I think it will give us more of a clue as to why it is included kind of seemingly randomly right here in the narrative. Moses wrote the book of Exodus, and he wrote it during a later trial of the Hebrew people, namely, after wandering in the wilderness for decades. God's people, at the time of the writing of Exodus, are in a hopeless situation. Can you imagine living in the wilderness, watching a whole generation die, and still believing that you are going to conquer the entire land of Canaan filled with powerful kingdoms? When this genealogy is inserted into the story in Exodus 6, 14 through 30, the people are angry at Moses, angry about the increased workload that Pharaoh has placed on them in making bricks without straw. They were in an equally hopeless situation back then, making bricks without straw in Egypt, as when the book of Exodus was written. So to answer the question, why is this genealogy placed here in the story? First, it reminds the reader, the first readers of this book, who are in a hopeless situation, that God has brought them through incredible trials before, and he can do it again. That nothing is hopeless, ultimately. Nothing is a hopeless situation for God. That truth should be an encouragement for you today, Christian. I know many of you have been or are in situations that seem totally hopeless, and that's not an exaggeration. As this genealogy served as a reminder to its first readers of who they were, and what they had come and what had come before, I would say, let's do the same and let it do the same for you. If you are a Christian, you are one of God's people. You are a spiritual descendant of Jacob, of this family. And God is with you like he was with them. Another significant purpose that this genealogy serves is that it reminds people that Moses and Aaron are indeed God's chosen leaders, his prophet priests, and rightful rulers. Until I look back through, I did not remember how many times the Hebrews grumbled against Moses, and sometimes Aaron and Miriam were targets of that grumbling as well. There were times when Moses was even threatened with death at the hands of the very people God had freed from slavery through Moses' work. The foremen grumbled when Pharaoh increased their work. When the people are freed but soon trapped against the Red Sea, they turn their fear and bitterness on Moses. They grumbled about the bitter waters of Marah in the next chapter, chapter 15 of Exodus. In chapter 16, they're hungry and they complain, wishing to return to Egypt. In chapter 17, they accuse Moses of bringing them out of Egypt and their children and their animals just to die of thirst. In Exodus 32, when Moses has gone too long on Mount Sinai, the people reject him and God and make a calf to worship. Even Aaron and Miriam question why Moses is their leader in Numbers 12. And of course, there's Korah's rebellion that we've already discussed. And there's other examples too, but I think you get the picture. This genealogy served to remind the people not only of who Moses and Aaron were, but that God had used them before to bring them through hopeless situations. And the genealogy does not glorify who they were. It reminds them of their questionable parentage. It tells of Moses' sins and failures and doubts all throughout. But look back at Exodus 6, 26 through 27. After going through the genealogy, the text emphasizes this very clearly. It says, "These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, 'Bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their hosts.' It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt. This Moses and Aaron." So Moses and Aaron are identified twice, very clearly. In verse 26, it says, "These are the Aaron and Moses." And then again in verse 27, it basically says, "This Moses and Aaron." It says it twice. It's almost as if to say to the people when this was written, when they are still in the wilderness, probably soon after one of the many rebellions against Moses' leadership, these really are the guys that God chose. And keep in mind that by that point, much of the generation that escaped from Egypt had probably died in the wilderness. Some of the purpose here may have been to confirm with the next generation that was about to go into the promised land that, yes, these imperfect guys, Moses and Aaron, really were used by God to bring low the most powerful empire on earth and lead his people to freedom. But it's not ultimately about them. The message ultimately was, look what God can do. There's more we could talk about in relation to this passage, but I think the most helpful thing to remind you of is this, that God can do it. On a global scale, as we look at things like the spread of Islam today, the commonness of corruption, the persecution of Christians in many areas, it could seem hopeless. We could look at our nation in its current state, having run from God now for generations. We've run from God and his ways. Things could look hopeless. And as you look at your own life and situation, whether it's your job, your health, your marriage, a besetting sin, a difficult child, a difficult parent, things might look hopeless. Well, like this genealogy reminded the Hebrews of who they were, sons and daughters of Jacob, God's people, you, Christian, be reminded of that. If you are a Christian, you are of the chosen race of God. And as this genealogy reminded the Hebrews of the impossible situations that God had brought them through, it should do the same for you. For a moment, step back. Take a look at your life, where God has brought you, what he has brought you out of. And consider in time, through the work of the Holy Spirit and the working of his will through you, where he might bring you in the days and weeks and years to come. So as this genealogy made a people in the wilderness look back at the trials that they had come before and how God had made the impossible possible, may we consider what God has done, where he has brought us to, and have real and true hope in the power of Christ today. Let's pray.